Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 15th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, features a shiny new bulldozer. Chief Justice John Roberts is driving the bulldozer, and Justice Samuel Alito is sitting in the cockpit with him. They are pushing over a table that's got a ballot box on it and just shattered the table, and the ballots are flying out of the box. To the side and back a little bit are Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks with alarmed looks on their faces. The headline is Demolishing Voting Rights. Has the Roberts Court pushed the country into a new Jim Crow era? We get that on the Talking Points page. We'll start with the first main story. Trump searches for an exit ramp in Iran. What happened? U.S. policy on Iran whipsawed this week, with President Trump telling Tehran to accept a peace deal or face a new wave of bombing, soon after he'd hailed great progress in talks and halted a military operation to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Trump had announced that, in a humanitarian gesture, the U.S. would guide merchant ships through the strait, a key oil export route that has been effectively shuttered by Iran since the start of the nine-week-old war. Any interference with Project Freedom would be met forcefully, Trump said. But as U.S. warships escorted two commercial vessels through the strait, Iran launched a barrage of missiles and drones. None of the ships were damaged, and U.S. attack helicopters sank six Iranian military speedboats. Iranian strikes hit a major oil hub in the United Arab Emirates and at least two commercial ships in the Persian Gulf. Trump declined to say Iran had violated a four-week ceasefire, calling the clash a mini-war. A day later, he paused Project Freedom, citing movement toward a complete and final agreement with Tehran. Trump's U-turn came hours after Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters that Operation Epic Fury is concluded and that the war's objective had been achieved, despite Iran's continuing chokehold on the strait and the lack of any deal over its nuclear program. Axios reported that U.S. officials believe they are nearing an agreement with Tehran on a one-page memorandum of understanding to end the war and set the stage for detailed negotiations. The war will end, assuming Iran agrees to give what has been agreed to, Trump posted online, which is perhaps a big assumption. If they don't, he said, bombing will resume at a much higher level and intensity. What the columnist said. Both sides are working with mediators to craft a 14-point framework, said Benoit Faucon in the Wall Street Journal. The working version calls for Iran to begin opening the strait and the U.S. to wind down its blockade of Iranian ports during 30 days of talks. Iran is said to be willing to discuss a possible halt to uranium enrichment and the removal of some of its stockpile of near-weapons-grade uranium to a third country, but not the U.S. Divisions within Iran's leadership could prove a roadblock, said Barak Ravid in Axios. Given the challenge of uniting disparate factions, some U.S. officials are skeptical that even an initial deal will be reached. Project Freedom had two objectives, said Chaz Danner in New York. One was to pressure Iran to fully open the strait and free 1,600 commercial ships stuck in the Persian Gulf, which failed miserably. The other was a cynical attempt to rebrand the war, which became illegal once it hit 60 days without congressional authorization. The administration wants the public to believe the offensive has ended and that the U.S. is now engaged in an entirely different defensive operation to open the strait. The administration can say whatever it wants, but that does not make it true, said David E. Sanger in the New York Times. The war is not over, and its objectives have not been met. Trump cited five at the outset, including regime change and ensuring Iran can never have a nuclear weapon. Only one goal, disabling Iran's navy, has been achieved. But the war has become a political crisis, and the White House is anxious to put it in the rearview mirror. Americans can see the cost of this war everywhere, said Scott Waldman and Ben Lefebvre in Politico. Gas hit an average of $4.54 a gallon this week, up $1.56 since fighting began in February. And diesel hit $5.67, up $1.91. The spike in diesel, which powers trucks and trains, in turn is expected to drive up prices for everything from groceries to postage. Trump's disapproval rating is climbing as well, hitting a record 62% in a new poll, said Scott Clement and Dan Baltz in The Washington Post. Americans disapprove of his handling of the war by 66% to 33%, and his approval rating on the economy has dropped to 34%. There are now only two outcomes to the conflict, said Scott Anderson in The New York Times. With Iran not about to cave, Trump can resume hostilities, but that seems unlikely. And no amount of bombing will change the fact that Iran has gained control of the strait and the ability to paralyze the global economy. The alternative is a settlement that will leave the empowered Iranian regime intact and a blustering American president humiliated. Operation Epic Fury is now looking more like Operation Colossal Blunder. Our controversy of the week, Blanche targeting Comey to please Trump. When President Trump fired Attorney General Pam Bondi last month, there was a chance for the Justice Department to end its serial courtroom embarrassment, said the Washington Post in an editorial, but that seems to not be in the cards. Todd Blanche, Bondi's former deputy and her interim replacement, announced last week that the Justice Department has yet again indicted James Comey, the former FBI director whom Trump blames for the Russiagate scandal. Comey's first indictment on bogus perjury charges was rightly tossed last November, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review, and the new indictment is even more absurd. It alleges that a photo Comey shared on Instagram last May of seashells arranged on a beach to spell out 8647, 86 being slang for getting rid of something, and Trump being the 47th president, constituted a serious threat to take the life of and to inflict bodily harm upon the President of the United States. Comey says he's still innocent, and it's inconceivable he'll be convicted. But that isn't the point. Trump wants him to suffer the anxiety, expense, and stigma of the judicial process. And in acting, A.G. Blanche, who hopes to have the acting designation removed from his title, he's found someone willing to shred not only the DOJ's credibility, but also Americans' right to free expression. There's a crime here, but it isn't Comey's, said Chris Trial in the USA Today. This case is a naked abuse of prosecutorial power in which the facts and law are irrelevant, and it's commonly used. 86 has no murderous connotations whatsoever. And even if Comey's shells had spelled out kill, the Supreme Court established in 1969's Watts v. U.S. that violent political hyperbole is protected speech. Blanche knows this case is fatally flawed, said Edith Olmstead in the New Republic. He struggled last week to explain why he hasn't indicted Jack Posobiec, a MAGA influencer who in 2022 posted 8646 about then-President Joe Biden, or gone after the many Americans who sell and buy 8647 merchandise on Amazon. Clearly, 86 is only a crime when posted by someone who Trump has decided is his enemy. Even by standards of the second Trump administration, Blanche is proving to be unusually dangerous, said Quinta Jurecic in the Atlantic. Under his leadership, the DOJ has indicted the left-leaning Southern Poverty Law Center for the non-crime of using paid informants to infiltrate extremist groups and submitted a bizarre court filing that channels Trump's voice to demand construction of his beloved ballroom be allowed to resume. Those opposed, said the motion, are very bad for our country and suffer from Trump derangement syndrome. This departure from the DOJ's professional, careful, and scrupulously unemotive prose signals Blanche's deeper rejection of fairness and neutrality, and how far he's willing to go to please the president. It will never be enough, said Glenn Thrush in the New York Times. Trump knows Blanche wants to be Bondi's permanent replacement, but also that a stopgap AG who feels he's fighting for the job will have ever greater incentive to execute his increasingly extreme demands. Persecuting Trump's enemies, especially if it makes Americans think twice before criticizing him, is a reliable path to the boss's heart, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. But the boss is a results-oriented guy. When the Comey case collapses, as it will, Blanche will likely find himself tossed aside, just another underwhelming henchman who destroyed his own reputation while failing to make Trump's dreams of retribution come true. Here's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for knowing your critters. After President Trump boasted at a White House small business event that he has taken a cognitive assessment test 3 times in recent years and aced each one. Among the questions Trump said he faced was, you have a lion, a bear, an alligator, and what's another good? A squirrel. Which is the squirrel? It was a good week for death from below after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, asked by a reporter if Iran had deployed bomb-carrying dolphins in the Strait of Hormuz, said he can confirm that Iran does not possess such weapons, but added, I can't confirm or deny whether we have kamikaze dolphins. And it was a good week for Jean-Paul Sartre after a new poll found that a third of Americans feel they're undergoing an existential crisis. Asked to describe the year so far, 35% described it as stressful, while a more stoic 32% said they're merely finding the work of existence challenging. But it was a bad week for Robert Prevost, who reportedly phoned his U.S. bank to change his address after becoming Pope Leo XIV. Only to be told he'd have to come into the branch. The customer service rep hung up after the Chicago-born pontiff said, would it matter if I told you I'm Pope Leo? It was a bad week for monarchists after Ryan Frost, 36, Texas man living in Northern Ireland, appeared in Belfast court charged with running a complex fraud scheme with the goal of raising an army to invade the U.S. on behalf of Queen Elizabeth II. This was obviously after Queen Elizabeth had unfortunately died, noted the presiding judge. Finally, it was a bad week for affordability after Starbucks CEO Brian Nickel pushed back against criticism of the chain's $9 coffee drinks. Customers want a premium experience, Nickel said, adding that he envisioned some math-savvy customers saying to themselves, well, it's less than $10. The title of this week's briefing is The Mississippi Miracle. The Magnolia State has leapfrogged ahead in youth literacy. Can it be a national model? How has Mississippi improved? For years, southern states with struggling education systems could console themselves. No matter how poorly they were doing, they weren't as bad as Mississippi. Just 12 years ago, Mississippi ranked 48th in K-12 education based on metrics like attendance, reading proficiency, and on-time graduation. Now the state is no longer a punchline. It's up to 16th in K-12 rankings and has achieved particular success in fourth grade reading comprehension, jumping all the way to the top 10 in the National Assessment Education Progress, NAEP. When adjusting for poverty and other demographic factors, Mississippi actually tops the nation in that category. Crucially, improvements are seen among students at all reading levels, rather than just among higher-achieving or lower-achieving students, said Dan McGrath, a retired federal education official who oversaw the tests. It's as if Mississippi had moved a mountain, and it did this despite spending just $12,000 per student, much less than the national average. What did it change? Mississippi passed the Literacy-Based Promotion Act in 2013, paving the way for implementing the science of reading in K-3 classrooms. This multifaceted approach, which involves teaching phonics, word recognition, vocabulary, and text comprehension, gets much of the credit for the state's turnaround. But it's just one tenet of the law. Accountability from both students and schools is another. Mississippi grades its schools A to F and sends coaches to train teachers in low-performing ones. Students get to see and track their own testing data. "I like it," one pupil, Johnny, told the New York Times. "If I make a bad grade, but I'm going up, it's like a staircase." At the end of third grade, those who don't pass a literacy exam after multiple attempts are automatically held back. That third grade gate has drawn praise as a tough but beneficial rule that's paying off. A record 77.3% of third graders passed the initial administration last year. Yet it also has its share of critics. What do they say? They say Mississippi has stacked its deck. Of course, all the fourth graders can read, they say. The kids who couldn't were kept back in the third grade. In 2023, fully 7% of Mississippi third graders, over 2,000 kids, were held back. One study in the statistics journal Significance said Mississippi's approach amounts to gaming the system. Others point out that Mississippi's scores didn't even improve much. It's just that other states got worse. Still, some research indicates that something real is happening. A Florida State University study found compulsory grade repetition alone can't explain higher test scores. Mississippi's literacy gains have also remained consistent across every decile on the NAEP exam. A 90th percentile score, for instance, leaped from 249 in 2005 to 262 in 2024, and a 10th percentile score from 157 to 170. Andrew Ho, a testing expert at Harvard, told Chalkbeat that he doesn't see any smoking guns or red flags around Mississippi's success. That's why other states are starting to copy it. What are other states doing? Across the South, states from Louisiana to Virginia have adopted at least some of Mississippi's strategies, including teacher training methods, curriculum reform, and high standards. Florida, Indiana, North Carolina, and Oklahoma have even copied the third grade gate approach. Now Louisiana leads the country in recovery from pandemic-related losses in reading, while Alabama takes the crown for math recovery. These states particularly shine when NAEP scores are adjusted for demographics. After considering factors like poverty and race, the Urban Institute think tank determined Mississippi tops the nation in fourth grade reading, fourth grade math, and eighth grade math, and it's fourth in eighth grade reading. Still, not everyone is satisfied with Mississippi's middle school progress. What happened in middle school? If you don't adjust for demographics, Mississippi 8th graders rank a dismal 41st in reading. Things are getting better. Between 2013 and 2022, its 8th graders cut their gap with the national average in half. But the pace has been slower than in lower grades. That's hardly a surprise since the 2013 law focused specifically on improving early education literacy. The state hasn't invested the same time, money, and resources into middle school reading, the time when literacy instruction shifts from learning to read to reading to learn. Critics say Mississippi needs to ensure that older children can read and that students' math skills get the same attention as their reading skills. Is the state planning to do that? Mississippi is now looking to pass a bill that would expand the 2013 literacy reforms into higher grades. The teachers tend to appreciate the help from literacy coaches. Mississippi education official Tanette Smith says, "We hear from teachers and administrators who say, 'I didn't know what I didn't know.'" The state also seeks to adopt similar reforms for primary school mathematics, mandating math coaches in all schools, prioritizing grades 2 to 6, and placing a cutoff gate for 5th grade so that only students who are ready will move on to 6th grade algebra classes. Pilot programs are already underway to improve reading comprehension in upper grades. While it's too soon to tell whether those efforts will pay off long term, the early test results are promising. The Mississippi miracle is proof positive that, yes, children in poverty can learn and can succeed, said Carrie Wright, Mississippi's former superintendent of education. As educators, our job is to do whatever it takes. Moving into the best columns of the week, I think we'll take all three of the columns from the U.S. this week. First up, why Putin is hiding in bunkers. Russia's annual Victory Day celebration is starting to feel like defeat, said Kathy Young. With Ukrainian drones penetrating deep into Russia and even hitting Moscow, President Vladimir Putin has drastically scaled back the country's celebration of its World War II victory, canceling the usual display of missiles and tanks. Putin even pressed Ukraine for a ceasefire on Victory Day. Ukraine has altered the course of the war with its innovative drone and robotic ground vehicle technology, which is slaughtering tens of thousands of Russian troops along the front in eastern Ukraine. With the war going badly and Russia's economy imploding, Putin is even more paranoid than usual and is reported to be spending much of his time in bunkers to avoid a coup or assassination. Drone attacks on Russian oil refineries have cut oil production by 40% and have turned the Black Sea port of Tokhtsi into an environmental disaster with apocalyptic fires, oil spills, and toxic smoke. In Russian media, criticism of the dead-end war and of Putin himself is growing bolder. With each passing month, Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine is looking more and more like a disastrous mistake. The ruinous cost of hospital care. Americans justifiably feel boiling rage over soaring health care costs, said Zach Cooper, but they're directing their anger at the wrong culprit. It's easy to blame insurers because they're the most visible and frustrating part of the health system. But sky-high hospital prices are the primary reason insurance premiums have increased 320% in 25 years. Americans pay far more than people in other advanced countries for similar care. A U.S. hospital, for example, charges an average of $29,000 for a hip replacement. But in Germany, it's $9,400. Hospitals get away with inflated prices because 1,300 mergers in recent decades have given them near monopolies. Today, 21% have no competitor within a 30-minute drive. Hospitals escape blame because people are grateful for care. They're also a formidable lobbying force, spending more than $100 million a year in Washington. But the industry's 25 years of price increases have left care unaffordable, and regulation is the only tool left. Congress should limit the prices monopoly hospitals can negotiate with private insurers. We can't address rising health care costs until we acknowledge that tension between the immense good that hospitals do and the economic harm their market power creates. A new effort to limit birth control. The Trump administration is now pursuing the most serious effort in decades to curb contraception, said Mary Ziegler. The Department of Health and Human Services recently unveiled an overhaul to its Title X grant program that promotes natural family planning over the birth control pill, IUDs, and other means of contraception. The administration is also expected to strip all remaining federal funding from Planned Parenthood, a major provider of contraception. Opposing birth control should be a political third rail, as 90% of Americans support widespread access. But President Trump is under pressure from the unwieldy political coalition of social conservatives, MAHA zealots, and anti-immigrant extremists who want Americans to have more children. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s MAHA movement claims that contraceptive pills and implants are artificial and unsafe. Instead, his department is now promoting fertility and pregnancy. For family planning, it recommends the Rhythm Method and unreliable tracking apps. Taking a hostile stance toward birth control helps Trump appease religious conservatives before the midterms. Contraception has gone from being politically untouchable to a real target on the right. And the last word, our feature article, running out of juice. Florida's once mighty orange industry is in brutal terminal decline, said Alexander Salmon in Slate. Are outside invaders to blame, or is the culprit closer to home? Quiet fell over the room, which was neither full nor very loud to begin with, and the 2026 Florida Citrus Show began. It should be a great day, began the event's first speaker. Rain should hold off today, even though we definitely need more rain. No one laughed. There was no need to say that things were bad. Everyone knew it. The mood wasn't sour. Citrus farmers could handle sour. It was something else. Post-apocalyptic. Florida is in the midst of its worst drought in 25 years. But the dry spell actually ranked far down the list of challenges these bedraggled growers were facing. In 2003, the mighty Florida orange industry produced 242 million boxes of fruit, with 90 pounds of oranges per box, most of which went on to become orange juice. Now, not even 25 years later, the U.S. Department of Agriculture was forecasting a pitiful 12 million boxes of oranges, the least in more than 100 years, the worst year since last, a decline of more than 95%. And everyone knew, more or less, that even that figure was not happening. 12 million? I would doubt it, Matt Joyner, CEO of Florida Citrus Mutual, the state's largest trade group, told me. In Florida, the citrus capital of the world, you are today more likely to see the oranges printed on the state's 18 million license plates than a box of actual fruit. Rick Dantzler, Chief Operating Officer of the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, took the podium. He was blunt. It's been a dumpster fire of a year, he said. On the list of immediate problems, the implementation of tariffs and retaliatory tariffs, then the government shutdown, then a stunning historic freeze, days long, at the end of January and early February that besieged the fragile orange trees. And yet those two were just footnotes to the even larger problem. Already, Florida had lost about three-quarters of its citrus growers. The last of them, these spent survivors, these hangers-on, had trudged to the citrus show to talk about the real problem, which was the disease. In 2005, Florida first got signs of a new affliction in its groves called citrus greening disease. It also has a Chinese name, Huanglongbing, or HLB, because it came from China, where oranges also came from in the first place. Citrus greening disease is caused by a bacterial infection that is delivered by the gnawing of the Asian citrus psyllid. It's now believed the psyllid first turned up near the port of Miami in 1998. The flea-sized psyllid bites the leaves and transmits the disease, which slowly chokes out the tree's vascular system from the inside, taking years to finally show itself. By the time a tree is displaying symptoms, 3 to 5 years, in most cases, it's too late. Industry groups in the state poured money, millions, into finding a cure, and every time they thought they'd figured it out, it didn't work. And the greening accelerated. Hurricanes turned out to be a vector for spreading the little winged bug. The wind carried the psyllid all over the state, dropping it off in hundreds of thousands of acres of groves. Soon enough, trees everywhere were showing blotchy, mottled, yellowed leaves and suffering from twig dieback and sparse foliage. Under duress, the trees would drop all their fruit on the ground prematurely. What rare fruit survived to maturity on these little adult trees was misshapen, acrid, and stubbornly green on one end. In short, it tasted terrible. Even after being squeezed and processed and pasteurized, the juice was gross. Now, according to the University of Florida website, the disease is incurable. I asked numerous people, farmers and industry leaders and researchers, to estimate how many trees in Florida have greening. The answer was resounding, 100%, every single tree. After lunch, the bad news kept coming. It wasn't just greening that had to be worried about. There were root nematodes launching a subterranean attack. There was citrus canker, a viral infection that had plagued citrus for years prior to the arrival of greening. It, too, came from China. Then came a seminar on citrus black spot, another recent arrival. Things have deteriorated quickly. 3-4 years ago, the juice was 80% from Florida, said Weston Johnston of the Coca-Cola Company, which owns Minute Maid. Now we're 20% Florida. A quintessential crop and national icon of the 20th century in America was dying before our eyes. And outside this room, the country, even Florida itself, had barely noticed. Juice shots were being given out in tiny 1.5-ounce bottles, made with orange-like hybrids with tolerance to HLB. This juice is an innovation that represents the future of citrus, a sign said next to the cooler. 100% American juice, boasted the label. I drank it. It didn't taste very good. As with his beloved Florida citrus, Dantzler's on the way out. Age 70, retiring from the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, which, after losing its state's funding, was getting absorbed by another group anyway. He met me in Lake Alfred at the site of its University of Florida satellite campus. I asked him to drive me through the best groves in the heart of citrus country. It's going to be a lot of houses, he warned me. It breaks my heart. The first stop on our tour was a brand new grocery store with a sprawling parking lot in front. This was a fantastic grove. It's now turning into a Publix, he said, matter-of-factly. The next stop was a gas station. This used to be a really great grove right here where this Circle K is going in, said Dantzler on cue. You drive down here in the spring and it'd smell so good you'd think you were in a perfume shop, he said, as we passed through Polk County. It was March, and if you rolled down the window, the only scent was exhaust. We crossed into Dundee. This was the heart of the industry. The best growers in Florida were right here. All the varieties in Florida were located right here. It was almost like a seed bank, so if a catastrophe happened, the industry could always replant, said Dantzler. Catastrophes kind of happened, he'd added, but the seed bank grove was no longer there. We drove past more empty lots, more abandoned groves, desiccated trees, signs announcing public hearings for land use changes. Dantzler told me that he didn't see 2005, when greening symptoms first became clear, or 2017 with Hurricane Irma as the turning point. He pegged it to 2007, when another invasive species took off, the one that now dominated the landscape on our drive, suburban sprawl. It was not inevitable. In the mid-1970s, Florida began a period of environmental enlightenment. In the course of three decades, the state passed all sorts of legislation, from wetlands protection to local government growth management initiatives. Then came the heady days of 2007 when, as you might remember, Florida's housing developers overbuilt so dramatically and financed so dubiously that they helped bring the whole global economy down with them, the Great Recession. The state government, despite desperate to stimulate the economy and its moribund real estate sector, began eroding the growth management plan that had restrained development. The Department of Community Affairs, the state agency that oversaw all the local government growth, planning, and limited development, was just abolished outright. By certain estimates, Polk County, where we were driving, has been the fastest growing area in America, and the developers have been cashing in. A citrus grove must be planted in sand, which occurs naturally by some geological miracle in Central Florida. But sandy land is the easiest property to develop. So while the growers were losing money hand over fist, housing developers were coming through with godfather offers to buy them out, convert the land to row housing, and sell, sell, sell. Flags of every home building giant flew on vanquished ground. D.R. Horton, Lennar. At nearly every intersection, there were signs for cheap housing. No money down, homes in the low 200,000s, yes, for real, in 2026. Bunting and grand openings and exclusive offers abounded. And so real estate was on the march, and even the citrus industry legends had become deserters. After the Gulf Citrus Growers Association shut down in 2024, its president, Wayne Simmons, a fifth-generation citrus grower, became a realtor. He wasn't the only one. Alico's Joshua Grove was the largest citrus grove in Florida, likely the largest contiguous grove in the country, except that in January 2025, Alico, the largest citrus grower in Florida, the largest citrus producer in America, announced in a release that it was done. Its orange era was over. So the Joshua Grove is now actually Florida's largest citrus graveyard. In all, Alico began gutting 53,000 citrus acres at the end of 2025 harvest, 35% of Florida's citrus production, condemned in one press release, which meant every tree under Alico management in the Joshua Grove was dead, dying, or already gone. Because of outstanding leases, third-party caretakers were getting one final season to manage 3,500-odd acres. The harvest ends in early April now. It used to stretch into June, so the oranges here would be the very last to ever come off the property. Mitch Hutchcraft, Alico's executive vice president of real estate, agreed to give me a personal tour of this citrus necropolis. The grove was more remote than anything I'd seen, south of the ridge in DeSoto County, without a house in sight. It was also enormous, 7 miles on one side, nearly 7 miles on the other, all planted in tight rows, stretching beyond the horizon, which, in flat Florida, is really saying something. A gate guard lifted the arm, and we drove in. To the right, he pointed, was an old grass runway where pesticide planes once landed and took off. We began to roll past dead and dying trees in various stages of decay. Some were blackened, shriveled, barren of leaves. Others had fruit sitting on the ground beneath. Most of not quite orange, rotting. They go pretty quickly, Hutchcraft said. Alico, as part of its plan to become a diversified land company, was turning 25% of its land, what else, commercial and residential development. Already it was underway with the construction of two villages. A year prior, the company unveiled Corkscrew Grove East Village and Corkscrew Grove West Village, a 9,000-home development. They had similar plans for Bonnet Lake in Highlands County, Saddlebag Grove in Polk County, and Plant World in Hendry County. The remaining 75%, like the Joshua Grove, which remained too remote for housing development, would be put to other agricultural uses. That meant row crops. That meant cattle grazing. The company would also be pursuing mineral extraction and oil. Already it had tens of thousands of acres in oil production. Alico had done everything it could, Hutchcraft told me. Soon enough, they would begin to turn this land over. A front-end loader would roll down the seemingly endless aisles and pop the trees out one by one. With their shallow root systems, addled by disease, the trees wouldn't put up much resistance. Then they'd push the carcasses into piles and burn them. We pulled up to a harvest wagon, a large flatbed. It was empty. Picture, said Hutchcraft, laborers going up and down the rows with bags on their shoulders, picking orange fruit and filling them, and then lugging the bags to tubs at the ends of rows. There they'd emptied the bags into the tubs. The trucks would go up and down the rows picking up the tubs. Finally, the trucks would disgorge their citrus into a harvest wagon, the giant flatbed, which would be driven by semi-truck to the processing center. Historically, these groves would throw off 500 boxes per acre. At the end, the company was lucky to get 90. There would have been harvest crews all up and down. You'd have seen trailers parked filled with fruit, he said. Now the harvest wagon was empty, and there were no trucks, and no tubs, and no shoulder bags, and no guys. Down the rows we went. Hamlin read a sign, and for miles in both directions were furrows and beds with only dirt or scrub brush or dead trees. Valencia read another, and the same. It was hard not to be nostalgic. But time had run out, and times had changed. Citrus was the profession that drove the state, was iconic state industry, Hutchcraft said. No longer. Orange juice had even lost the battle for shelf space to seltzers and energy drinks and more. Florida's always been a boom and bust state, said Hutchcraft. In the distance, a plume of smoke rose, likely dead trees burning, though it was hard to see from so far. This was abridged from a story originally published in Slate. We'll read a couple of the health and science shorts this week. Zapping depression at home. The FDA has approved a headset that treats depression at home by sending a mild electric current through the brain, reports Scientific American. The device, made by Swedish company Flow Neuroscience and available in Europe since 2019, uses a technique called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS, which delivers a weak current via electrode pads on the forehead. It is far gentler than electroconvulsive therapy, which triggers seizures and can cause memory loss. The idea behind TDCS is that depression involves impaired connectivity between neurons, and a small current can lower the threshold for them to fire, helping the brain work more effectively. In the trial that led to the approval, 174 people with moderate to severe depression administered mild shocks to themselves 5 days a week. After 10 weeks, 45% of those receiving the treatment experienced full remission, compared with 22% in the control group. The device is part of a broader push to find psychiatric treatments that go beyond antidepressant pills, now taken by nearly 1 in 6 Americans. It expands the therapeutic landscape in a space that sorely needs more accessible interventions, said neuroscientist Robert Reinhardt of Boston University. It's not a panacea, but it's a meaningful expansion of the toolkit. Silencing the feed me voice. GLP-1 drugs help people lose weight not just by suppressing appetite. It turns out they also help quiet what researchers call food noise, persistent, intrusive mental chatter about what to eat next. These unwanted, recurring thoughts of food cause significant distress and are associated with obesity. More than 50% of obese people report experiencing them. The concept first gained the attention of doctors when the users of GLP-1 drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy began reporting that the medications turned off that inner voice that was constantly telling them to focus on eating. Researchers now believe that food noise is driven by biology, not willpower, involving both hormones and brain chemistry to lock a person into a relentless fixation on food. When users of GLP-1 drugs stop taking the medication, the inner voice comes roaring back. For many GLP-1 users, the reduction in food noise is one of the most meaningful outcomes, Nina Crowley, a health psychologist, tells U.S. News and World Report, even independent of weight loss. And on the Talking Points page, we do have that article that was referenced in the cover drawing. SCOTUS, ending the South's majority black districts. The Supreme Court has authorized Republican-run states to disenfranchise black voters, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. A 6-3 majority split along ideological lines ruled last week in Louisiana versus Calais that a Louisiana redistricting map that created 2 majority black districts out of 6 in a state whose population is 1/3 black was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The decision effectively gutted Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in voting. Justice Samuel Alito's majority opinion was steeped in reactionary colored blindness, pretending to be neutral about race in order to preserve an unjust racial hierarchy. Alito argued that states are only in violation of the VRA if they draw districts intentionally disadvantage minority voters. If states seek partisan advantage in redistricting, Alito said, that's constitutional under a 2019 Supreme Court ruling, as if disadvantaging Democrats doesn't also disadvantage blacks. In other words, according to Chief Justice John Roberts and his allies, preventing Louisiana from disenfranchising black voters is racist. As a result of this mind-boggling piece of judicial overreach, said the New York Times in an editorial, red states like Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi can slice minority voters into small and powerless slivers, so long as they claim race isn't the reason. Once again, the court obviously acted more like partisan legislators than like impartial judges. Its 6 conservative justices, all nominated by Republicans, have most likely made it easier for the party that chose them to hold power in Congress. The Voting Rights Act was a landmark of American liberty that helped to break Jim Crow, said the Wall Street Journal. But it's not 1965 anymore. As Alito noted, black voters now participate in elections at similar rates as the rest of the electorate. This ruling will finally help end Democrats' partisan abuse of race to carve up congressional districts. In the name of preventing the dilution of black votes, Louisiana was compelled to draw up a preposterous majority-minority district that snakes 250 miles across the state. In their dissent, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post, three liberal justices conflated the right to vote with the right to have the satisfaction of voting for the winner. Sometimes, say for Republicans in San Francisco or Democrats in Wyoming, our preferred candidates lose, and we have to accept the outcome of the legislative process anyway. In a representative democracy, being outnumbered is not the same as being disenfranchised. The reality is that Calais will be devastating for communities of color, said Ari Berman and Mother Jones. During the Jim Crow era, black Americans had essentially no representation in Congress, even in southern states with large black populations. But with the forceful support of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement, the VRA put an end to decades of white supremacy and one-party rule across the South. As Justice Elena Kagan put it in an anguished dissent, the law was born of the literal blood of Union soldiers and civil rights marchers. She pointed out that the VRA has proved so essential in bringing this nation closer to fulfilling the ideals of democracy and racial equality that Congress has reauthorized it five times, including in 2006, when the Senate voted 98-0. By rendering the law toothless, the court will likely trigger the largest drop in black representation since the end of Reconstruction. And legal recourse will be all but impossible, said Erwin Kimerinsky in the Los Angeles Times. In theory, states can still be sued if they draw districts to discriminate by race. But as Kagan put it, without smoking gun evidence of a race-based motive, a prospect she deemed almost fanciful, the law is now moot. The court's ruling will trigger an all-out redistricting war, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. Calais is such an effusive love letter to the concept of partisan gerrymandering that states will have no fear of rigging districts to favor the party in power. Louisiana, with the Supreme Court's blessing, has already delayed its primary so it can redraw its map, while Tennessee's GOP governor called a special session to discuss doing the same. Republican-controlled Alabama may follow suit. Democrats will respond in kind, said Andrew Egger in the Bulwark. Many in the party are pledging to continue the fight fire with fire approach they've carried out successfully over the last year in California and Virginia. By 2028, both red and blue states may eliminate most or all congressional seats held by the minority party. How is this absurd gerrymandering tit-for-tat good for democracy? Will anyone in Congress dare to find some anti-gerrymandering measures on which there's an appetite for bipartisan agreement? If Americans are sick of this partisan race to the bottom, they should demand it. Media, Trump versus Kimmel, round two. The Trump administration is once again at war with Jimmy Kimmel, said Nitish Pawa in Slate, and this time its crosshairs aren't trained on late-night host alone. Federal Communications Commission Chair Brendan Carr last week ordered an unprecedented early license review of ABC's eight broadcast TV stations and claimed the review is tied to an investigation of diversity policies at ABC parent company Disney. He's not fooling anyone. This is pure presidential vendetta. The FCC made its move just 24 hours after First Lady Melania Trump demanded that ABC take a stand following the latest assassination attempt on President Trump and fire Kimmel for his violent rhetoric. His offense? Joking before the attack that Melania had a glow like an expectant widow. That gag was aimed at the first couple's age difference and wasn't Kimmel activating some sleeper cell hitman. But for Carr, who pressured Disney into briefly suspending Kimmel last year, it was another opportunity to show broadcasters what happens when their talent dares mock the president. Kimmel's tasteless joke isn't a matter for the government, said National Review in an editorial. With late-night shows losing their cultural influence, Most of the country only hears about him when he says something stupid. Carr's preposterous threats against ABC will only further Kimmel's transformation into the world's most annoying martyr for free speech. When he returned to the air after his last suspension, he earned his highest ratings in a decade. During the Biden administration, conservatives were rightly outraged that the White House coordinated with social media firms to suppress views that challenged the government's draconian COVID policies. We should be equally outraged that those same powers are now being used to quash jokes. It's likely the FCC's attempt to pull ABC affiliates from the air will go nowhere. Disney has deep pockets, and its lawyers won't let the company go quietly into the night. But the fact that Trump administration is so clearly copying the authoritarian tricks of Russians Vladimir Putin and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan shows just how far from democratic norms it has strayed. Disney may be able to afford the hassle, but Carr and Trump know that many smaller media firms will likely self-censor rather than submit to such a long and costly legal fight. The process itself has become the punishment. On the poll watch, 64% of adults are worried about being able to afford health care costs. 64% are worried about gasoline and other transportation costs. 61% say health care costs will influence which party's candidate they support. And we will finish today's show with a quote from Mahatma Gandhi, who says, "Our ability to reach unity in diversity will be the beauty and the test of our civilization." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.